Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear brother and sister. Welcome. This is today's special from IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for choosing this program to listen to, where we're going to speak about living a blessed life.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
And today's Friday, 21st of Jamadil Thani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 21st of Azar, 1404 of the Solar calendar, and the 12th of December, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. For today, we open Allah's book and we'll listen to one verse from the Holy Quran, from chapter Al-Imran, verse 173. We learn more.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. الذين قال لهم الناس إن الناس قد جمعوا لكم فاخشوهم فزادهم إيمانا وقالوا حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل.
Those to whom hypocrites said, "Indeed, the people have gathered against you, so fear them." But it merely increased them in faith, and they said, "Sufficient for us is Allah, and He is the best disposer of affairs."
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The enemy propagating agents and some simple-minded and coward people advisingly inspire that a group of enemies strong and none can combat them, so it is better not to entangle ourselves with fight. The true believers, without any fear and as they are qualified in the verse, calmly answer them. So the strongest barrier against all the threats of the enemy is faith and trusting in Allah. When a believer happens to be inflicted with disasters, he increases his reliance with Allah.
Shukran ya Rabbi, shukran. Hadayta qalbi, shukran. Nawarta darbi, shukran. Shukran ya Rabbi,
shukran ya Rabbi, shukran. Hadayta qalbi, shukran. Nawarta darbi, shukran. Shukran ya Rabbi. يا منزل القرآن يا خالق الإنسان يا ربي يا رحمن شكرا يا.
Today we continue speaking about living a blessed life. Islam teaches that faith and action go hand in hand. Almighty Allah has given people free will, and the measure of one's faith is one's deeds and actions. However, human beings have also been created weak and regularly fall into sin. This is the nature of the human being as created by Almighty Allah in His wisdom, and it is not inherently corrupt or in need of repair. This is because the doors of repentance are always open to all human beings, and Almighty Allah loves the repentant sinner more than one who does not sin at all. The true balance of an Islamic life is established by having a healthy fear of Almighty Allah, as well as a sincere belief in His infinite mercy. A life without fear of Allah Almighty leads to sin and disobedience. While believing that we have sinned so much that Allah will not possibly forgive us, only leads to despair. In light of this, Islam teaches that only the misguided people despair of the mercy of their Lord.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, today we have another topic to discuss about. If life is a blessing, are we looking at the life as a blessing? Life is a blessing to the extent that it allows the soul to turn away from illusion and toward what is truly real and good. Even death is not necessarily a loss in this vision, because the soul continues its journey. So the blessing of the life is part of a longer metaphysical story. Modern existentialist thinkers question whether life has any built-in meaning at all. They noted that the universe appears indifferent to human hopes, and that people face freedom, responsibility, and mortality without clear instructions. Yet instead of concluding that life is a curse, existentialists often argue that the capacity to choose, commit, and create meaning is itself a remarkable gift. In this sense, life is a blessing, not because it comes with ready-made answers, but because it offers the freedom to define oneself through choices and relationships. A person may experience emptiness or absurdity, yet by engaging in authentic projects, loving others, building communities, seeking truth, the same life becomes meaningful. The blessing is bound up with freedom, even though freedom also brings anxiety and risk. The philosophy of religion asks whether life's value depends on a relationship to something beyond the world, such as God or transcendent good. Many religion philosophers argue that if humans are created with a purpose, then life is inherently precious, even when individuals cannot see the full picture.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio.
May this moment last forever in your hearts, a day you'll always remember every part.
Today's special.
This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time.
One question, how can we attain the good life? It is part of the process to develop solutions to our problems by acknowledging our present. This includes our emotions, human limitations, and even our shortcomings. Know that our religion does not intend anyone to walk a self-destructive path and seeks to end everything in life. Allah says in the Holy Quran, in chapter 2, chapter Al-Baqarah, verse 195, "Do not put yourselves into destruction, and do good." Of course, Allah loves those who do good. This means that we should seek to take care of ourselves physically, mentally, and spiritually. Amongst many, we may observe dhikr, or remembrance of Allah in dire times to help calm ourselves, instill hope, and return to mindfully looking for solutions. Dhikr allows us to acknowledge that we can never go through the challenges alone. You are listening to today's special from IRIB English Radio, and in this part, what actions increase barakah in one's life? One way can be gratitude. While increase generally refers to an increase in faith and righteous deeds, there is also the increase of provisions because the believer uses the existing wealth and resources with true gratitude. Gratitude, thus, is to use the blessings of Allah in a manner that is pleasing to Him. To be grateful with health is to use one's energy to do good. Sinfulness in the Islamic worldview might be the reason a believer is prevented from provision, relief from hardship, or divine blessings. Allah says in the Holy Quran, chapter 71, verses 10 to 12, is truly most forgiving. He will shower you with abundant rain, supply you with wealth and children, and give you gardens as well as rivers.
Life as a blessing can be unfolded much more deeply by examining its roots in philosophy, religion, psychology, and everyday ethics, and by asking what it means in a world that contains both joy and intense suffering. When people can call life a blessing, they are usually doing more than expressing optimism. They are making a claim about value, purpose, and how humans should live. So let's look at the ancient philosophy and the value of life. Ancient Greek thinkers already wrestled with whether life is intrinsically good or only conditionally good. For Aristotle, life becomes truly blessed when it is lived in accordance with values and virtues, meaning that reason governs desires and actions in a balanced way. In this framework, the blessing of life is not automatic. It is realized when a person grows into wisdom, courage, moderation, and justice over time. Plato, by contrast, emphasized that the visible world is imperfect and changeable, while the highest good lies in eternal realities such as truth and goodness.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of today's special, which in that way speak about a blessed life and the ways, of course. Follow us. Thank you and fi amanillah.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Rabbi, Muhammad Nabi, Aliyul Imami, Lafata illa Ali, Aliyul Imami. علي إمامي علي إمامي
لا إله إلا الله الله ربي
محمد نبي علي إمامي
لفتى
You can talk it down, turn the other way. Fear the truth, but it won't go away. Can you hear it calling? Yeah. You can write it down, but nobody cares. It's an untold story of our biggest fears. It can reach you with no warning. Yeah, yeah. When the sun there's a part of me that won't understand, having sleepless nights with my head in my hands. I'm here and tears are falling, yeah. If I could right the wrongs, would you lend me a hand? I would make a difference to this beautiful land. If I'm nothing, I have my intention. When the sun goes down and there's nothing left around, can you feel it? Can you feel it? When your knees are on the ground, you may fear, but it's allowed. Are you listening? 'Cause I need forgiving. I need forgiving.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Yearning for your cure, this humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, salam. And welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Today we reflect on a luminous teaching of Imam Hussein al-Salam. It's a very beautiful one. It's quoted to have said, "Our true followers are those whose hearts are free from deceit, malice, and corruption." This short sentence is like a mirror, asking us to look inside ourselves. What really defines loyalty to Ahlul Bayt is not just slogans or rituals, it's the purity of the heart. So guys, you know that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, not many hadiths are quoted from him. They are fewer. This is one of them and it is very important. Actually, the conditions for being a real Shia was very important to them, and they kind of acted seriously about it. They were so serious about like claiming to be a Shia, they set conditions for it. You cannot just simply claim to be a Shia to Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Why? Because imagine a person who wants truly, honestly, sincerely to find the right path, the true path to God, and he cannot find it anywhere. He looks and looks for it. And then he finds Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Then he looks at his Shia to be, you know, those who claim to be their Shia. And they see them deceiving others, having deceits in their hearts, and like acting corruptly. So how can they find the true path? So Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam told us not to claim to be Shias arbitrarily. We cannot simply claim to be their Shia. We want to, we hope to be their Shia, but to claim that we are already their Shia, that's a very tough claim, that they don't like it to happen for all in vain. The first quality Imam Hussain alayhi salam mentions is being free from ghish, actually, deceit. Deceit is when we present a false image hiding selfish intentions behind kind words. Psychology calls this duplicity. And research shows it damages both the deceiver and the deceived. And the second quality is being free from ghil, or malice, or hatred. Carrying grudges poisons the soul. And neuroscience tells us that resentment activates the same stress circuits as physical pain. But forgiveness, on the other hand, calms the brain and improves health. I have experienced that, and you have. So inshallah, we experience it more often. The third word is daghal, or inner corruption, hypocrisy, or moral decay. It's when someone looks religious on the outside but hides selfish motives within. So let us carry this light within us. Honesty instead of deceit, forgiveness instead of malice, and sincerity instead of corruption. That is how we walk with Imam Hussain alayhi salam, not just in words, but in the very state of our hearts. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
May peace, blessings, and God's mercy be with you all. Everything mentioned so far serves merely as an example of the manifestations, outcomes, and some consequences of direct American hegemony over Iraq since the military invasion in 2003, particularly in the economic, financial, and oil sectors. Having examined the background and causes of this domination, we will now delve into the origins of comprehensive American hegemony over Iraq and its roots. For over a century, although the occupiers of our lands have changed and the slogans and justifications for occupation and invasion have evolved, the fundamental goal remains unchanged: to dominate our territories, their resources, and the Arab world. This reality is not exclusive to Iraq, but extends throughout the entire region, from British and French colonialism after World War I to American hegemony in both its old and modern forms. The American hegemony in Iraq is an extension of colonial history. The U.S. intervention did not start with the 2003 invasion or the sanctions imposed in 1990. The true American hegemony has lasted for over 70 years. Although it was not exhaustive or complete at the beginning, it specifically began with the precursors to the establishment of the Baghdad Pact in 1955. Even though the United States was not a partner in the pact, it did support it. This agreement was established under the pretext of confronting communist movements and Arab nationalism led by Egypt under the leadership of Gamal Abdel Nasser. If we look further back, even before the Baghdad Pact, we can assert that the strategy of American hegemony has been deeply entrenched. Even Noam Chomsky, in an article titled Modern American Imperialism, the Middle East and Beyond, published on April 24, 2008, traces the history of American hegemony back to before the Spanish-American War of 1898, suggesting that the United States is inherently a hegemonic power, as we discussed in previous episodes, most recent one being on November 28, 2025, titled The United States in Our Lands, Neither to Defend Israel Nor to Confront Iran. Looking back a bit in history to analyze the roots of the global hegemony that led to the domination of Iraq, imperialism began its transformation from its classical form in the 19th century, shifting from traditional military occupation to a global system of economic and political dominance. At the start of this transformation, powers like Germany, Japan, and the United States emerged to compete with Great Britain and other European nations for influence. Europe was thrust into a frantic race for the division of Africa and the control of markets and finances. These factors, along with others, led to the outbreak of World War I. After this war, the Treaty of Versailles marked a second phase of imperialism aimed at dividing the spoils and confronting communism. However, this project was interrupted by the Great Depression, which began with the collapse of the U.S. stock market in 1929 and World War II. With the conclusion of World War II, the leadership of colonial powers shifted from Great Britain to the United States. The United States later developed the Greater Middle East Initiative, a plan aimed at ensuring complete control over the strategic centers of the global economy under the guise of openness and free trade. This shift in leadership saw American imperialism take on new forms, such as international financial institutions, the monetary system, military alliances, and indirect interventions. Control over nations began to be exercised under the pretense of global order, no longer labeled as occupation. Focusing specifically on Iraq, following the end of World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, Britain discovered a geographical and economic treasure. It occupied Iraq in 1917 and established a mandate system endorsed by the League of Nations. However, the truth is that this mandate was nothing more than a form of real colonialism disguised as a diplomatic document with a dedication signed by the League of Nations. London solidified its control over Iraqi oil through the Iraq Petroleum Company, shaping the modern state's map to serve its strategic interests. This design involved imposing a foreign king, Faisal I, and establishing an army primarily tasked with protecting the British crown rather than ensuring the safety of the Iraqi people. Despite popular uprisings in Iraq, particularly the 1920 revolution, Britain maintained its grip through political treaties, economic dominance, military presence, and infiltration of the ruling elites. In this way, Iraq emerged as a nominally independent and sovereign state, but in practice, it was subordinate to the British crown. After the conclusion of World War II, Washington stepped onto the stage, taking advantage of the decline of the British Empire and the rise of the United States as a global power. Iraq became a crucial piece in the conflict between East and West. The United States supported the Baghdad Pact in 1955, seemingly to contain the Soviet Union, and attempted to infiltrate the Iraqi army and administration. It employed political and media tools to undermine any nationalist projects that threatened its interests, particularly in the oil sector. With the 1958 revolution and the fall of the monarchy, it seemed that Iraq was beginning to break free from its colonial legacy. Despite its shift towards Arab nationalism or its adoption of this under the leadership of Abdel Karim Qasim and later the Ba'ath Party, Iraq remained a constant testing ground for American influence. This was exerted through conditional aid, intelligence agencies, and even through the manipulation of the head of state himself, such as Saddam, whom Washington used in the 1980s as a tool against Iran, before he became a target to eliminate. Since the mid-20th century, the United States' policy towards Iraq has had a consistent goal to keep the country within its regional and global interests and to prevent Iraq from becoming an independent state that could pose a potential threat to those interests. The methods used have been diverse, ranging from covert interventions to economic pressures, military dominance, and control over institutions. Nevertheless, the ultimate aim has always remained the same, to ensure U.S. access to vital resources, especially oil, and to keep Iraq within the sphere of American influence. The initial tools of hegemony were intelligence and covert intervention. In the 1950s and 1960s, there were signs of U.S. support for elements and factions within the Iraqi army and for political movements capable of shifting the internal balance of power when necessary. We recall here the U.S. role in the Ba'ath Party coup and its rise to power in 1963. Another tool, both then and now, is tactical and economic support for regimes or leaders with whom collaboration can be established to achieve U.S. interests. For instance, in the 1980s, with the outbreak of Saddam's war against Iran, the United States reopened diplomatic and commercial channels with Iraq. The United States reopened diplomatic and commercial channels with Baghdad, providing intelligence data, indirect support, and at times direct assistance to Saddam's regime. If covert influence or alliances failed, Washington would turn to economic power, international pressure, and even military force. Following Saddam's invasion of Kuwait in 1990, an international military campaign led by the United States was launched under the banner of liberating Kuwait. Although the stated goal was to free an independent state, the real aim was to control another country and ultimately establish a permanent military presence in the Persian Gulf while securing its oil. Washington led a massive coalition and enforced a suffocating embargo on Iraq for 13 years. This embargo devastated the infrastructure, weakened society, and paved the way for a phase of total domination. Programs like Oil for Food illustrated how international restrictions limited and fragmented the Iraqi state's ability to manage the resources of the Iraqi people. In 2003, the U.S. invasion of Iraq became the most perilous step due to the negative consequences for Iraq, its people, and the entire region. The project to strangle and control Iraq was based on the falsehood of spreading democracy and misleading claims of weapons of mass destruction. The American forces burst into Iraq to overthrow the regime and the Iraqi state within weeks. The Iraqi army was disbanded, institutions were dismantled, and the doors were wide open to sectarianism, corruption, and the systematic plundering of wealth. In reality, the American occupation of Iraq was the culmination of a century of colonial policies. Among the strategies employed by Washington was political control through a quota system that ensured the division and fragmentation of the elite, thereby preventing the establishment of an Iraqi state modeled after a unified national state. Secondly, economic dominance is achieved through the privatization of a significant portion of the public sector and the connection of Iraq to international financial institutions. This results in the Iraqi economy becoming reliant on debt and imports. Thirdly, military and security influence is achieved through the training and equipping of the army and security forces, the establishment of permanent military bases, and the signing of strategic partnership agreements. Fourthly, cultural and media penetration is achieved through the promotion of the liberal democracy model based on American standards, along with support from media networks and civil society organizations that are funded to sway public opinion. In fifth place, the management of natural resources is carried out, particularly regarding oil, through long-term contracts that ensure the ongoing control of Western companies over every production and marketing. In sixth place, support is provided to sectarian, regional, tribal, or clan parties and leaders with the aim of fragmenting the political landscape and limiting the space for inclusive national action. In seventh place, international institutions, particularly the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank, WB, are used to dictate the terms of reconstruction and debt, imposing structural economic reforms that undermine the Iraqi state's ability to make independent decisions. As noted, the American plan and methods for domination over Iraq are an extension of the country's colonial history. Furthermore, they are a crucial part of the Greater Middle East Project, a long-term strategic vision that the United States began to articulate after the Cold War and which solidified following the events of September 11, 2001. The aim of this project is to reshape the political, economic, and social geography of the countries in the region, which stretches from Morocco to Pakistan. This initiative has ancient roots and was developed by a group of American diplomats, economists, and thinkers. The initial outlines emerged in the 1990s with the New World Order speech delivered by George H.W. Bush following the collapse of the Soviet Union. This plan evolved into an official project under the leadership of George W. Bush in 2004, which was formalized as the Greater Middle East and North Africa Initiative. The stated goal was to promote democracy and political and economic reforms in the Arab and Islamic world, but the underlying aim was to reshape the map of influence and borders to benefit U.S. hegemony. Additionally, the aim was to connect the target countries to a unified network of economic and security interests, naturally led by Washington, so that this vast region could become an alternative sphere of U.S. strategic influence to ensure its global dominance against China. This project also has implicit goals, particularly the dismantling of major central states like Iraq, Syria, Sudan, Egypt, and Iran into smaller sectarian or ethnic entities to facilitate their control. Additionally, there is a constant goal of ensuring Israel's security by dismantling the powerful neighboring states and transforming the Arab-Israeli conflict from an existential liberation struggle against the colonial power into a mere cultural and developmental issue. This, of course, secures Israel's safety as the primary tool of hegemony over the countries in the region. Thirdly, another implicit goal is to manage energy resources, oil and gas, through subordinate regimes or Western companies. It's important to note that this objective is openly discussed by thinkers, researchers, and some U.S. officials. Fourthly, it's essential to contain China, Russia, and Iran, preventing any Asian-Eurasian axis from competing with Washington in the strategic waterways of the Persian Gulf, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the Suez Canal, and the Mediterranean. Fifthly, one of the key objectives is also to re-engineer the political and social culture within Arab societies through media, education, and civil organizations. Since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003, this war has been more than just a territorial or regime struggle. It's been a battle over the very meaning of sovereignty. Iraq was not only invaded by armies, but also by ideas, promises, debts, and structures specifically designed to hinder its recovery. The occupation marked the beginning of a new phase and a different form of American hegemony, where military control evolved into a continuous system renewed through various tools, including military bases, oil contracts, financial influence, and a democracy directed and managed from abroad. Prominent American thinkers point out, military force alone does not create legitimacy, and imposing control does not equate to achieving stability. The Iraq that Washington aimed to subjugate is the same Iraq that revealed the fragility of its imperial project when the invasion turned into a strategic burden. However, empires do not easily surrender and always replace their tools with new ones that allow them to maintain their overall dominance, albeit in different ways than before. Today, more than two decades after the fall of Baghdad, the most pressing question remains. Has Iraq truly freed itself from occupation, or has its captivity merely been reconfigured within a global system that denies it full sovereignty? The answer is not straightforward. The United States will not allow Iraq to easily respond to this question through complete liberation and genuine independence without resistance. However, it is true that the journey towards true independence is not solely measured by the withdrawal of armies, but by the ability of people to break the chains of hegemony, whether they are visible or hidden. I'll see you next week, inshallah, for a new episode.
Reach out for you to hold my hand. The rain may fall, but united we stand. Our prophet guided the children, they grew into be men. He taught the brothers be equal and respect your friend.
Let's recite the Quran.
وإذا قرأت القرآن جعلنا بينك وبين الذين لا يؤمنون بالآخرة حجابا مستورا.
القرآن نور وبيان. القرآن هدي الإيمان. القرآن مسك الختام. سلام.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Welcome to this edition of Let's Recite the Quran. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and with me today in the studio, the usual brothers, Brother Ali, Hassan, Hussein, and Masoom. Welcome to you all, brothers, and welcome to this program, dear listeners. And inshallah, this episode, we will be beginning a new chapter of the Noble Quran, Suratul Jinn. It's a very scary topic, but it's not a scary surah, and inshallah we will try to learn to recite this chapter with tajweed and proper recitation, inshallah. Without any further ado, I'll ask Brother Ali to please recite the first verse of this chapter, beginning with A'udhu Billahi Minash Shaitanir Rajeem. Brother Ali?
Yes. A'udhu Billahi Minash Shaitanir Rajeem. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم قل أوحي إلي أنه استمع نفر من الجن فقالوا إنا سمعنا قرآنا عجبا
أحسنتم نفر من الجن. There is a ghunna for jinn involved over here. Okay, let's begin from the beginning of the verse. قل قل قاف is a letter of tafkhim, qul, a rounded mouth and a heavy voice. Qul uhiya ilayya anna. Anna, because noon is shad, that we apply ghunna in this case. Ghunna basically means a nasal sound plus a small stretch up to two beats or two counts. Now, just keep that in mind. You have to memorize ghunna. We were going to be using ghunna a lot in almost every part of tajweed. Now there is an alif I see in my Quran text at the beginning of istama'a. Why didn't I recite the alif with the haraka, Brother Ali? Why didn't I say annahu istama'a? Rather, I recited annahu istama'a.
Because this is hamzatul wasl?
Exactly. So this is Hamzatul Wasl. Usually you will find Hamzatul Wasl with a Sad on top of them, right? If they're at the beginning of your recitation, like you have done Waqf or it's the beginning of the verse, what you have to do is you have to look at the first Haraka of the word. So if it is Fatha or Kasra, we apply Kasra. Istama'a. The first Haraka is what? Fatha on Ta. Istama'a. Tama'a. Right? Istama'a. So we apply kasra for alif al-wasl if we are beginning the recitation. However, if we find that that we are continuing the recitation, we're not beginning at the alif al-wasl, we just consider as if the alif al-wasl was never there. It's non-existent. It's completely silent. قُلْ أُوحِيَ إِلَيَّ أَنَّهُ اسْتَمَعَ. There is no أَنَّهُ اسْتَمَعَ. أَنَّهُ اسْتَمَعَ. نَفَرٌ مِّنَ الْجِنِّ. نَفَرٌ, again, Ra is a letter of tafkhim, and also there is نَفَرٌ مِّنَ الْجِنِّ. There was its tanween. Original recitation, it would have been نَفَرٌ مِّنَ الْجِنِّ, but I recited this way, which is the correct way, نَفَرٌ مِّنَ الْجِنِّ. Why is that so, Brother Ali?
نَفَرٌ مِّنَ الْجِنِّ.
Yeah,
we have idgham.
Idgham of the tanween of the Nafarun, right, with the meme, right? The ruling of idgham basically says that whenever we have a noon sakin or a tanween, and after that we have yarmanun letters, ya, ra, meem, lam, waw, and noon, any of these letters, we apply the merging of the noon and these letters. In this case, we have meem, right? We are merging the noon, nafarun, with meem, nafarum, right? So it becomes, it's merged. And this idgham is with
Ghunna,
correct. So if we had any of the letters Ra or Lam of the Yarmanun letters, remember these are letters of Idgham, right? We do not apply Ghunna. But in this case, we have Mim, which is one of the Idgham letters, but it is not Ra and Lam. We apply Ghunna in this case. Nafarum minal jinni. Keep in mind, Ghunna again is a nasal sound and a small stretch. Minal jinni. And because Noon is Shadda over Noon Mushaddad, always has a Ghunna involved with it, right? Faqalu, not faqalu. Faqalu. Why? Tafkhim. Qaf is a letter of tafkhim. فَقَالُوا, and there is a mad at the end of قَالُوا. What kind of a mad is it?
جَائِز.
جَائِز, meaning that you can stretch the قَالُوا, the loo of the قَالُوا, up until five, or you can go for four as well.
فَقَالُوا إِنَّا سَمِعْنَا, again, إِنَّا, غُنَّا is involved because of noon, شَدَّ on the noon. سَمِعْنَا قُرْآنًا عَجَبًا.
Now we recited Qur'an and Ajaba without Ghunna. Why? Because there is no ruling that applies Ghunna in this case. It's just Idhar. It's not Qur'an and Ajaba. No. Qur'an and Ajaba. And also Qur'an, Qaf and Ra are Tafkhim. That is Qur'an. But the Hamza after the Qaf and Ra, it's Tarqiq. Qur'an and Ajaba. Ahsantum.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
قُلْ أُوحِيَ إِلَيَّ أَنَّهُ اسْتَمَعَ نَفَرٌ مِّنَ الْجِنِّ فَقَالُوا إِنَّا سَمِعْنَا قُرْآنًا عَجَبًا.
Say, O Muhammad, it has been revealed to me that a group of the jinn listened and said, indeed, we have heard an amazing Quran.
We'll move on to the next verse, brother Hassan. Bismillah, verse number 2 of Surah Jinn.
يَهْدِي إِلَى الرُّشْدِ فَآمَنَّا بِهِ.
Ahsan, to continue.
وَلَن نُشْرِكَ بِرَبِّنَا أَحَدًا.
Ahsantum, a very beautiful recitation. Yahdi, again, this is a ja'iz munfasil mad, meaning that you can go for four beats or up to five or even six beats, right? Yahdi ila rushdi. Rushd, a tafkhim letter. Because ra is not always tafkhim letter, it's only whenever we have fatha or dhamma on top of ra, we apply tafkhim on ra. Tafkhim means a heavy sound and a rounded mouth.
يَهْدِي إِلَى الرُّشْدِ فَآمَنَّا بِهِ.
Now noon, because it's mushadda over here, it's shadda on noon, فَآمَنَّا, we apply غُنَّا over here as well. Now there is a waqf salah, meaning that you can continue, but it's better that you continue, but you can also stop over here, as you did in the recitation, which is completely fine. There is no problem in that.
يَهْدِي إِلَى الرُّشْدِ فَآمَنَّا بِهِ وَلَن نُشْرِكَ بِرَبِّنَا أَحَدًا.
There is also an idgham at وَلَن نُشْرِكَ, the noon at the end of لَن and the noon at the beginning of نُشْرِكَ. This idgham of مِثْلَيْن, when two noons are next to each other. Remember يَرْمَلُون, we did merging, right? The last letter of يَرْمَلُون is what? Noon. So whenever we have a noon sakin or tanween, and then after that we have any يَرْمَلُون letters, and in this case we have noon, what happens? We do idgham, we merge the two letters, and we're merging the two noons, and because it's noon, we do it with ghunna. If it was lam or ra, we do not do it with ghunna. Correct?
وَلَن نُشْرِكَ بِرَبِّنَا أَحَدًا.
أحسنتم.
يَهْدِي إِلَى الرُّشْدِ فَآمَنَّا بِهِ وَلَن نُشْرِكَ بِرَبِّنَا أَحَدًا.
It guides to the right course, and we have believed in it, and we will never associate with our Lord anyone.
Verse number 3 of Suratul Jinn, Brother Ma'soom, please take the honors.
وَأَنَّهُ تَعَالَى جَدُّ رَبِّنَا مَتَّخَذَ صَاحِبَةً وَلَا وَلَدًا.
أحسنتم, a very beautiful recitation. وَأَنَّهُ تَعَالَى جَدُّ رَبِّنَا, not رَبِّنَا, رَبِّنَا, تَفْخِيم, right? A rounded mouth, the ra is, should be recited with a rounded mouth and a heavy sound.
وَمَتَّخَذَ, تَخَذَ, تَخَذَ, not تَخَذَ, تَخَذَ,
تَ is تَرْقِيق, ذَ is تَرْقِيق, but in the middle we have خَ, which is تَفْخِيم.
مَتَّخَذَ,
it's difficult, but with practice you will get the hang of it, inshallah.
صَاحِبَةً وَلَا وَلَدًا. صَاحِبَةً وَلَا وَلَدًا.
What ruling is applied over here, brother Ma'soom?
إِدْغَام.
وَلَا وَلَدًا.
إِدْغَام.
أحسنتم, إِدْغَام. إِدْغَام of noon and wow. And this is with غُنَّة, correct?
Yes.
صَاحِبَةً وَلَا وَلَدًا.
وأنه تعالى جد ربنا ما اتخذ صاحبة ولا ولدا.
And it teaches that exalted is the nobleness of our Lord. He has not taken a wife or a son.
In the last verse of this episode, verse number 4 of Surah Al-Jinn, chapter number 72 of the Noble Quran, Brother Hussein, please take the honor.
وأنه كان يقول سفيهنا على الله شططا.
أحسنتم. It's not يقول سفيهنا. There is no mad or stretching involved. يقول سفيهنا. Right? على الله شططا. Just 2 points and then we'll conclude this episode inshallah. على الله. Why did I recite the Allah with تفخيم? Lam is not a تفخيم letter. Why is that so?
Because before the word Allah, we have Ala.
Exactly.
It has,
so this ruling of tafkhim is specific to the word Allah.
Yes.
Right? Whenever before the word Allah, we have Fatha or Dhamma, we apply tafkhim on the Lam of Allah, the middle Lam of Allah. Ala Allahi astaghfirullahi. Right? But when we have a kasra before Allah, we apply tarqiq, a flattened sound, a smiling sound. Lillahi. Correct? And then the shatata, the ta and ta, both of them are tafkhim, but not the sha, not shatata. Shatata. Now, whenever, again, I keep emphasizing because it's a very important thing to practice. It's always good to practice verses that have tafkhim and tarqiq next to each other, preferably in one word. Prepares your tongue and mouth and your entire pronunciation to properly recite the Quran. Sha ta ta. You see that? Sha is flat, but then ta and ta are rounded with a heavy voice. Sha ta ta. With practice, everything becomes perfect.
وَأَنَّهُ كَانَ يَقُولُ سَفِيهُنَا عَلَى اللَّهِ شَطَطًا.
And that our foolish one has been saying about Allah an excessive transgression.
Alright, let's recite the verses number 1 to 4 of this episode, Surah Al-Jinn. A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul uhiya ilayya annahu istama'a nafarun minal jinni faqalu inna sami'na Qur'anan 'ajaba.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم قل أوحي إلي أنه استمع نفر من الجن فقالوا إنا سمعنا قرآنا عجبا
يهدي إلى الرشد فآمنا به ولن نشرك بربنا أحدا
يهدي إلى الرشد فآمنا به ولن نشرك بربنا أحدا
وأنه تعالى جد ربنا ما اتخذ صاحبة ولا ولدا
وأنه تعالى جد ربنا ما اتخذ صاحبة ولا ولدا
وأنه كان يقول سفيهنا على الله شططا
وأنه كان يقول سفيهنا على الله شططا
صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
And that was the end of this episode where we recited Surah Al-Jinn, chapter number 72, from verse number 1 to 4 of this chapter. We bid you farewell with wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala